The following episode of Annals on Call is brought to you by Annals of Internal Medicine. The views and opinions expressed by the hosts and participants during this episode are their own and do not necessarily reflect the views of the American College of Physicians, the editors of Annals of Internal Medicine, or the institutions that the speakers are affiliated with unless so identified. All relevant financial relationships have been mitigated. Information contained herein should never be used as a substitute for clinical judgment. For more episodes, links to CME and MOC, or to view disclosures, visit go.annals.org/oncall.
So we wanted to understand if long-term health expenditures were similar between patients undergoing the two most common procedures.
Welcome to Annals on Call, a podcast based upon articles from the Annals of Internal Medicine, in which we discuss the implications of the article for you, the listener. This is Dr. Bob Centaur. I'm Professor Emeritus at the University of Alabama at Birmingham and former Chair of the Board of Regents for the American College of Physicians.
This episode of Annals on Call features an article titled Health Expenditures of Patients with Diabetes After Bariatric Surgery, Comparing Gastric Bypass and Sleeve Gastrectomy. Our guests are both authors of this paper, Matt Maciejewski, who's a PhD and a professor in the Department of Population Health Sciences, and Dr. Carolyn Sloan, who's an MD, an assistant professor of medicine, whose research interests focus on the role that money plays in medical decision-making. We hope you enjoy this podcast. Well, Matt and Caroline, thank you so much for joining the podcast. I was really struck by this paper because we deal with so much obesity in internal medicine, seeing a lot of patients with bariatric surgery. Usually we see them after they've had surgery and down the road when they have complications. And knowing what the impact was financially was really fascinating to me. And your study surprised me a little bit, so I loved it. So maybe you could start out by telling us what the goal of the study was, and then a little bit about where you found the data.
Certainly. So, you know, few trials of bariatric surgery. There have been a number of trials of bariatric surgery done looking at clinical outcomes, but few of them have looked at healthcare costs or expenditures like we do here. And we had, in other work, I had compared long-term costs in a cohort of veterans who had bariatric surgery. But veterans who undergo bariatric surgery are very different than this cohort from Kaiser Permanente. So we wanted to understand if long-term health expenditures were similar between patients undergoing the two most common procedures. And in particular, the literature hadn't really examined long-term expenditures of patients undergoing sleeve gastrectomy, which is the most common surgical procedure. So we, with our colleagues at Kaiser, were able to get this data from their electronic medical record data from Kaiser in Washington State and Kaiser Southern California. And so they have really rich data on large cohorts of patients, and they knew healthcare utilization. They didn't have costs generated, so we had to do microcosting in order to generate costs from those utilization records for the different types of services that we evaluate costs of: outpatient visits, inpatient admissions, medications, and other outcomes.
How did you pick the patients?
We wanted to do what are sort of increasingly being recognized as target trial emulation methods. We wanted to include patients, all patients who were eligible for these two procedures, and got them between 2012 and 2019. And wanted to be able to generalize our results as widely as possible. So, you know, applied inclusion-exclusion criteria, but were but maintained most of both cohorts. And so basically just followed patients who were in the systems and followed them as long as they were observed in Kaiser.
Do I have this right that in order to get into the study, it was mostly people with type 2 diabetes, but no people with type 1?
Yes, we explicitly excluded patients with type 1 diabetes because there's been prior evaluation of clinical outcomes showing that patients with type 2 diabetes have better clinical outcomes after bariatric surgery than patients who don't have type 2 diabetes.
And then the last part of this before we get into some of the details is, so we're looking at gastric sleeve surgery versus Roux-en-Y surgery, which are dramatically different types of operations, I believe.
Yes. Yes.
So it seems like over the last 2 or 3 years, about every 3 months, I'm reviewing a study that used target trial emulation. And so we've discussed on the podcast before, but it's still, and I'm pretty good at statistics, but I'm still getting confused. So maybe y'all could simplify this as much as possible for our audience. What is a target trial emulation? Because it's not a randomized control trial.
Yeah, the basic idea promulgated by Miguel Hernan and Jamie Robbins and others is the idea that, right, we know that in the absence of randomization, that there's likely to be confounding. And with the limited measurements we have of confounders, there's probably a lot of unobserved confounding. And so to try to minimize that confounding and immortal time bias, we want to kind of construct our non-randomized cohort studies, kind of emulating what might be a feasible trial that one could envision doing in the real-world settings in which we're evaluating patients. And so that requires doing things like having inclusion-exclusion criteria that would only retain people who are eligible for the relevant arms, in this case, the two surgeries. That clearly identifies a time zero or start of follow-up that is aligned equivalently in the two cohorts to reduce any chance of immortal time bias, and try to do weighting or matching methods that increases the equivalence of the two cohorts that might make the table one kind of look like the two cohorts are similar on average, the way randomization does in a trial.
Okay.
That's the short answer.
Let's get into the meat and potatoes. Let's figure out what you found out.
Caroline, you want to take this one?
Yeah, sure. I guess a little bit of extra background. This study was part of a kind of larger study that we did where we were comparing patients with diabetes and obesity who underwent surgery and didn't undergo surgery. And that other analysis is presented in a different paper that's currently under review. And in this study, we just looked at people with diabetes and obesity who underwent Roux-en-Y versus underwent sleeve gastrectomy. And in preparation for this analysis, we matched surgical patients to non-surgical patients. And then we used propensity score matching to match patients who underwent sleeve gastrectomy to Roux-en-Y gastric bypass. And so the results are presented in our table one, comparing the baseline characteristics for people who underwent sleeve gastrectomy versus Roux-en-Y gastric bypass. And so overall, we found that the two cohorts were pretty similar. On average, there were 73% women. Average age or mean age was around 50 years old, and mean BMI was around 44. And that mean BMI can seem kind of high, but it's actually pretty consistent with other observational studies of patients who are with obesity who are undergoing bariatric surgery. And we then looked at expenditures in several different ways for these patients. We looked at total expenditures over time, pre-surgical and then post-surgical, 3 years before surgery and then 5.5 years after. And then we looked specifically at outpatient expenditures, medication expenditures, and inpatient admissions. And so what we found is that expenditures over time for surgical patients declined pre-surgery to after surgery, and that the expenditures for patients undergoing sleeve gastrectomy versus Roux-en-Y were pretty much exactly the same.
whether you look at overall expenditures or just medications or just outpatient expenditures. We couldn't analyze inpatient expenditures in exactly the same way because very few patients overall get readmitted after bariatric surgery. But we did find that there wasn't a large difference in inpatient admissions between the two groups.
And I'm really glad that you started out with table one, because to me, that's now I know who we're dealing with, because we all know those patients, and that puts in a lot of context. So the first thing we have to think about is what, and you both write nicely in the discussion some of the implications of these data, and then I'm going to really stretch you after that. So first of all, let's talk about how you think we should be using this information.
Yeah, great question. I mean, certainly payers and employers are trying to figure out, particularly with GLP-1s, how to deploy bariatric surgery and for whom maybe surgery is a really promising option. I think these results suggest that because there is a significant drop in total expenditures after surgery, and that expenditure drop is sustained in the long term, that bariatric surgery, the clinical benefits of bariatric surgery do translate into health expenditure reductions for patients with diabetes. And that's not the case for all comers, based on a paper we published in Annals of Surgery. And so it suggests that patients with diabetes, type 2 diabetes, may be particularly good candidates for bariatric surgery because there's great clinical benefits in terms of weight loss, survival, remission of many obesity-related conditions, and that those clinical benefits appear to translate into expenditure reductions. And we see that driven by the medication reductions through the remission of their conditions. And so to me, it suggests that patients with diabetes may be particularly good candidates for bariatric surgery. And since only 1% of eligible patients get it in any given year, these may be patients who might be particularly good, have good return on investment.
I'm really glad that we're doing this podcast because I don't think I focused well enough on the fact that this is a subset of patients with obesity. It's the subset that also have type 2 diabetes. And we don't have data here, at least, to translate to people who have the same amount of obesity but don't have type 2 diabetes.
Yes, we have a paper that was published in Annals of Surgery last year that has the all comers. And so this group in this paper are a subset of that cohort in that paper.
Really glad you mentioned GLP-1s because I'm getting ready to do another podcast on the use of different GLP-1s and the duo, and there's even now a triple one coming out for weight loss. So that's another way to lose weight. And we all know people who are on GLP-1s now, because we know people who can afford to be on GLP-1s, but we also know people who can't afford to be on GLP-1s. And so the question is, in this subset of patients, would GLP-1s do as well as bariatric surgery? Now, I know you can't answer that question because you don't have the data, but how are we going to figure that out? Because surgery is a major deal. And even though we know it decreases expenditures, but it does change quality of life in different ways in different people. GLP-1s change quality of life in different ways in different people, and they're all the rage. So I don't know. You do primary care, Caroline. How are you thinking about this right now, understanding that we don't have an answer?
Yeah, it's a great question, and we thought a lot about this for this paper and other work that we're doing. One thing we were all, this is a side answer, but I promise I'll get to the answer to your actual question. One other thing we were thinking about was, the current this study that we're talking about was evaluating patients who underwent surgery in 2012 to 2019. And during that time, yeah, GLP-1s existed and SGLT2s existed, but they weren't in as widespread use as they are now. And actually, in our cohort, only I think fewer than 2% of people were on GLP-1s or SGLT2. So this is like a basically GLP-1, SGLT2 free zone, the study. So one other thing that we've wondered is if we redid this study in an era where GLP-1s were in widespread use, what would the impact have been of bariatric surgery on expenditures? Especially since now, as of last year, I think the American Diabetes Association recommends that we start people on GLP-1s as their first line treatment if they have, cardiovascular disease or renal complications or obesity when they have diabetes. So one thing we've thought about is if you're on a GLP-1 and you have diabetes and then you undergo bariatric surgery and you lose a lot of weight and you go into diabetes remission, then you don't need the GLP-1 anymore. And so maybe expenditures would go down even more dramatically than we were able to show in this paper. Or people with diabetes, even if they go into remission, decide to stay on the GLP-1 because they're so effective. And then we don't see the savings that we see in this paper. So that's like another kind of side thing we've been wondering about. Like, if we redid this exact same study in the GLP-1 era, what would happen? And then your question about how do you decide as a primary care doctor to whether to start your patient on a GLP-1 versus send a patient to bariatric surgery? I think in my clinical experience, it's often potentially a combination of both. Start the GLP-1, then send them to the bariatric surgery referral place, and it takes, however many months to get evaluated. And some people can't, for whatever reason, undergo bariatric surgery, but they're still taking the GLP-1. So I think it's a little messier than just do you start someone on a GLP-1 or do you do bariatric surgery? But I think in the end, what probably needs to be done is a similar study where we compare expenditures among people who just got a GLP-1 versus people who underwent bariatric surgery and see which one leads to the most savings. And that could probably inform insurers who are trying to decide, should we cover both or should we just cover one or whatever.
Right. Thinking about it and knowing so many people who are taking GLP-1s who don't have a BMI of 44. But if you have BMI in the 30s, the GLP-1 may be all you need. We know from the other podcast that I'm going to be doing that the weight loss is depending upon which drug you use is in the 15 to 20% range. And so even if it was 20% and you started out at 44, that's only going to get you down to the high 30s. And so I like what you're saying, that probably what people are going to do is they're going to put them on a GLP-1, see what happens, maybe losing a little weight, and then getting stuck and saying, well, we go further with bariatric surgery. And it might stimulate some people who have been more reluctant, because we've all had patients who are reluctant to have bariatric surgery.
Right.
So I think this is really interesting. And I like that it's interesting both for what's the conundrum for the primary care physician, but it's also trying to inform, as y'all made very clear, the insurers that this could be return on investment, that investing in helping them lose weight has downstream positive effects on their bottom line. And so everybody's a winner. I really want to thank y'all for doing this study and explaining it to us. And I hope that you will continue to teach us more over time.
Thanks for the opportunity. We will have more papers coming out, so hope to continue this story, and appreciate your support for our work.
Yeah, thanks, Bob.
Now it's time for Bob's Pearls. This very interesting article focuses on the costs downstream after bariatric surgery. The patient population had an average BMI of 44 and was 73% women. They only include people with type 2 diabetes, and so therefore we cannot extrapolate from this study to patients without type 2 diabetes. They compared Roux-en-Y surgery to sleeve gastrectomy. They found very significant reductions in medications and found overall cost savings compared to time prior to surgery. This led to a return on investment for the insurers who paid for this. So it's clear that in people with type 2 diabetes and significant obesity, that there's cost savings from these surgeries. What is not clear, because this study was done prior to the use of GLP-1s for weight loss, is what role GLP-1 medications and the medications related to GLP-1 medications might impact on cost reductions. We can't compare them yet at this time, and we had an interesting discussion of how one might start the GLP-1 to see how weight loss is going, but many of these patients, especially those with BMIs in the 40s, may still need bariatric surgery. We hope that you've learned something from listening to this conversation, and thank you for listening.
Information contained herein should never be used as a substitute for clinical judgment. For more episodes, links to CME and MOC, or to view disclosures, visit go.annals.org/oncall.